Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Well, hello again, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as he typically does when we record podcasts, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
You enter a dark room that smells of mold. One sputtering torch is the only light source. A rough-hewn oak table sits at the center of the floor, surrounded by overturned chairs. On the table is a spoiled banquet left untouched for at least several days. As you glance around, you hear a quiet click, the sound of a trap going off. Quick, roll your saving throw.
How'd I do?
You took an arrow to the knee, so you will now be a guard.
So I can no longer be an adventurer?
Not like me.
Oh.
So we are today going to talk about the history of massively multiplayer online role-playing games. And it all actually stems back to what I was just alluding to, and all of you guys out there who are big D&D fans picked up on it, I'm sure, immediately. We're talking about Dungeons & Dragons. And it's important to talk about Dungeons & Dragons first to understand why MMORPGs exist at all.
Yeah, yeah. Now, there were some computer role-playing games, but they weren't like what we think of today.
Yeah.
And really, they came around right about the same time as D&D took off.
Yeah, so let's start with D&D, first of all, to kind of explain what's going on.
So we're not even talking about D&D online. We're actually talking about specifically about the pencil and paper and dice and all that jazz.
Game screens, etc. So back in 1974, there were some guys who had created a war game, a miniatures war game called Chainmail.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, war games are, they've been around for a while, right?
Yeah.
It's where you essentially have figures that represent military units.
Or you might even have what they used to call chits, those little pieces of cardboard that had the little number. They kind of look like, if you haven't seen these old style things, they actually sort of look like the periodic table. They have the picture of your unit and how many hit points it has and all that stuff.
Right. So the idea is that you would try and out-strategize your opponent playing on a map. And the map might have even topographical elements that would indicate how you might have an advantage or disadvantage in a given situation, depending upon your unit and where your enemy is located.
Right.
And anyway, the whole game was this idea of, you know, matching wits against an opponent. Well, chainmail kind of brought that down a little bit. Chainmail was an idea of using smaller units in very specific circumstances, like, say, in a castle or a dungeon.
Mm-hmm.
But then the game creators, among them a certain Gary Gygax,
I feel like I've heard that name before.
Yeah. Decided that what if we were to change this? So instead of playing, you know, controlling units, you control a specific character, someone who has a personality, a background, goals, motivations, they have their own abilities and their own disadvantages. And you were to take on this role within an adventure. And that was where the whole role-playing game idea kind of spawned out of. You would have someone who is in charge of explaining all the environments and taking care of all the game mechanics on the back end. That would be the dungeon master or game master.
Mm-hmm.
And then the players would each control a character and would try and pursue certain goals dependent upon the game itself and that character's personality. And this was kind of a radical idea at the time, back in 1974. And it caught, I guess you could say it was a popular idea, particularly among high school and college students.
Now, your characters, when you first start, there are some elements of chance involved here.
Yeah.
When you first create your character, you roll the dice to determine what the character's characteristics are.
Yeah, their attributes.
Yeah, like for example, strength, how strong that person is, or how much dexterity that person has.
Yeah.
The ability to get out of the way when somebody's swinging an axe at their head.
I haven't played D&D for about 20 years, but I remember that it used to range between 3 and 18 for normal characters.
Well, yes, because you roll
three six-sided
dice. The thing is, with the, you know, that's one aspect of it too. But the dungeon master or game master would use a screen to hide the dungeon or whatever it is that you were going adventuring in. So you didn't really know. Unlike those other games where you could see there were mountains ahead of your characters, you could go around the mountains.
Yeah.
When you came, you'll be riding six white horses. But meanwhile, in a dungeon and in D&D, you didn't necessarily know. And this is the difference in a role-playing game and those other games. You are actually pretending to be, you know, this character. So, one of the first things I had to learn, and when I started playing D&D, I was, I think, 8 years old or 9 years old.
Mm-hmm.
You had to learn that you can't see what's going on. So you have to remember to ask, what do I see? What do I hear? You know, and the dungeon master might not necessarily tell you you hear the click of a trap unless you ask. You're like, well, you just heard a clicking noise. Uh-oh.
Right. Yeah, that clicking noises in D&D were never a good thing.
No.
But you also had different play styles, right? You had people who would play very achievement oriented.
Yeah.
Right? They wanted to get whatever the goal was, and it was less about the experience of being a character. And then you had people who really kind of embraced the idea of role playing, being someone else, and to really kind of try and drive that aspect more than the rules necessarily. So you kind of had these two types, subcategories of players, rule players that were all about the statistics and getting the good rolls and getting the best equipment for their character because it would guarantee their success, that kind of thing. And role players who are more interested in the personality aspects. Most players fall somewhere within that spectrum between those two.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing holds true, by the way, of MMORPGs. So the only reason I even mention all of that is so that we have the foundation to build upon so that we understand once we get into MMORPGs why they're a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Well, computer role-playing games have been around, like I said, about as long as Dungeons & Dragons have, because that was they sort of went around at the rise of personal computers on the desktop, right about the same time, the mid to late 70s.
And they got popular in high schools and colleges, which were breeding grounds not just for role-playing games, but for computer sciences.
Yes, yes, that's true. The thing is, one of the reasons that that Dungeons & Dragons and other role-playing games took off was because it gave you an opportunity to play a game with your friends.
Yes.
You weren't sitting at home on one machine interacting with the game on the machine. I mean, that was fun, too. I like playing those games by myself also.
Yeah. We usually call those CRPGs, computer role-playing games.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily have a multiplayer element to them.
Right. But the multiplayer games, both on paper and computers, give you an opportunity to go through the experience with other people.
Right.
And which can be fun because you never know what those other people are going to do. And it also gives you this feeling of camaraderie.
Yes.
Esprit de corps, if you will.
And depending upon the game, it may allow certain players to band together and oppose other players. So you can even have elements within the game where you've got a struggle between two groups of players. And if the game is designed properly, meaning that it's, you know, a dynamic element to it, you might even be able to have players actually influence the course of the game's world.
Right.
Which is pretty tricky because, you know, that's a very delicate balance to create when you are a developer. You don't want to make it so easy to affect the game's world that it is, that one group of players essentially dominates and makes all the determinations of where the game's world is going. At the same time, you don't want it to be so static that it feels like no matter what you do, you don't influence the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
It's
mm-hmm.
a really tricky balance.
Well, I would argue that one of the things that makes online role-playing games so much fun is not necessarily the high graphics elements. I think the element of play is most important. That's one of the things. I mean, you don't see these things, these fantastic animations of spells and swordplay and whatever else that you might happen to be engaged in. When you're playing a tabletop role-playing game.
Yeah, you have to imagine it.
What? Imagine it?
Yeah, it's this thing that we used to do before there was the internet.
Well, I do love looking at the amazing graphics work of some of these game studios now, but, you know, the very first online role-playing games were text-based.
Yeah, in fact, we can talk a little bit about them. First of all, I want to define a couple of terms for the very earliest games.
Right.
Some of them were built on something called Plato, mm-hmm. which is an acronym for Programmed Logic for Automated Teaching Operations.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the funny thing.
This sucker predates pretty much all of this stuff that we're talking about.
Plato actually came out before D&D, the tabletop game came out.
Yeah, early 60s, actually.
But Plato was all about it was supposed to be an educational platform.
Yeah.
Which, of course, meant that students immediately figured out ways to play games on it. And like almost immediately.
Yeah.
Like, this is for education. I want to kill stuff. So the University of Illinois built Programmed Logic for Automated Teaching Operations. So it was a platform that could run on networked computers.
Yeah.
Now, these computers are networked to one another. They are not networked into a larger network.
Yeah. Think LAN party, not the internet.
Right. And immediately you had students start to figure out ways to create games because it meant that they could link it to other students and have a social experience on a computer,
mm-hmm.
which just shows you that, you know, we are very social creatures. The, you know, first thing we start looking at is how can we use this machine to connect to other people? So that's one acronym you need to know. Another one is MUD, which stands for...
I know all about that.
Multi-User Dungeons.
Oh, those two.
Not what happens when you add water to earth, which just makes me almost go off on a brack tangent, but I'm not going to. What happened to the water? Also with MUD come a couple of other topics or a couple other acronyms, Moo and Mush. Have you heard about those?
Yep.
So a Moo is a – Moo is an acronym that has an acronym in it because Moo stands for MUD – Object Oriented.
Mm-hmm.
MUSH stands for MUD User Shared Hallucination or Shared Hack or Shared Habitat or Shared Holodeck. It really depends on who you ask.
They're all pretty similar.
But these are basically the frameworks within which people built games. Now, back in 1975, there was a game that came out called Colossal Cave Adventure.
Yes.
Sometimes just called Adventure.
By William Crowther.
And it was a single-player text-based game. But it was what created the foundation for some of the multi-user games that came after it. In 1977 and published in 78, a game called Moria came out. And now Moria was built on top of Plato. There were other games that came out before Moria, but Moria is one of the more famous ones. And it allowed up to 10 players to get together in a party and go on a dungeon crawling adventure. And it was created with these very simple vector graphics.
Mm-hmm.
You see like the green wall with a green door outline on it, and you would push a command, it would knock the door open, and then you might have a encounter afterward, or you might find treasure, that kind of stuff. The interesting thing about it was, not only did it allow up to 10 people to play, that itself was interesting, but it also created the dungeons every time you played.
Yeah.
So the dungeons were not pre-generated. They generated dynamically when you would play the game. So you would never necessarily have the same experience twice because the dungeon would be randomly created when you started.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of an early example of how people were trying to kind of port the experience of playing Dungeons and Dragons or a game like D&D
right.
to a computer environment and not have it be a single player playing with computer generated characters. Although there are plenty of examples of that as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1978, a fellow named Roy Trubshaw created the very first multi-user dungeon, and it was called MUD. That's why we call them MUDs.
Yep.
Because he made it. It was, he was in Essex University, and so MUD became the generic term for games that were built in this way. And it became very, very popular. And then eventually, again, these were on network computers. Mm-hmm. There was no internet yet. But Trubshaw connected his game to the ARPANET in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
So suddenly you had essentially the ancestor to massively multiplayer online role-playing games because it gave access to people beyond just folks who had access to those specific computers within Essex University to play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my notes have the game down as being called Dungeon, D-U-N-G-E-N.
Oh, yeah?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I have it as – it was called Multi-User Dungeon.
Yeah.
So
– Well, yeah. Okay. So
But the same thing. I mean, that is where MUD came from. They probably – I'm sure it was called Dungeon just as for shorthand.
Yeah.
The next one I have doesn't pop up till 1980. Do you have anything you wanted to mention before I go to that?
No.
Okay. So in the University of Virginia, there were a couple of classmates, John Taylor and Kelton Flynn.
Mm-hmm.
And they created a game called The Dungeons of Kesmai, which was a six-player game. And it was also inspired by Dungeons & Dragons, and it used ASCII graphics to represent elements of the game.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, it's making me think of some of the old games I used to play. And they also founded a company in 82 called the Kesmai Company. A few years later, I'll mention it when it happens, but they would come up with another game that would be kind of a big influence on online role-playing games in the future.
Mm-hmm.
In 84, you had a fellow named Mark Peterson, who wrote The Realm of Angmar. And it was originally a kind of a offshoot of another game called The Scepter of Goth. And in 94, Peterson rewrote it and adapted it for MS-DOS, which I don't know how many of you guys remember MS-DOS. Wow. That's pre-Windows. But that was that formed the basis of a game that ended up being found on a lot of bulletin board systems. So if you guys heard our episode about BBSs,
mm-hmm.
you know that there used to be these communities, still are in many cases, but there were these communities that were housed on private individuals' computers,
mm-hmm.
although you could also have companies that do this too, but you could have a private individual who would open up their computer to allow other people to dial into their computer to access files and play games.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the games that was found on a lot of BBSs. And if the BBS would allow multiple people to call in at once, if they had multiple lines that would allow for that, then you can have people play this game simultaneously. And in 85, you had the introduction of Mirror World, which was a multi-user dungeon that could be run on a home computer as opposed to some, you know, research institution or university's computer.
Yeah, I remember the modem speeds back then. That was slow.
Yeah, yeah. I've got an interesting thing to mention in 91 about that. 85 was also the year that the Kezmai Corporation came out with Island of Kezmai, which is, again, Kelton Flynn and John Taylor. Mm-hmm. And this ran on CompuServe.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
Yeah. So it was the first commercial multiplayer online role-playing game. I don't think you could call it massive because it had a limit to how many players could play. 100. No, that's more than 100.
Compared to the earlier games, that's pretty massive.
Yeah, compared to, you know, the older Kezmai game where six people could play, or even the 10 player Moria game. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I think it's almost 10 times that.
Wow.
So I'm not that stupid, people. Almost, but not quite. In 1991, an interesting game comes out.
Yes.
Interesting for a couple of reasons, because for one thing, you can confuse it with another game by the same name. Neverwinter Nights by Don Daglow and Catherine Matega comes out. Has no connection at all to the Neverwinter Nights game that came out by BioWare. But this game ran on AOL. And
I've heard of it. No, I used that joke already.
And AOL used an interesting pricing mechanism. So this is a commercial game. You had to pay to play. And the way it worked was that you would pay $6 an hour to play this game at 300 baud.
And when we're talking hours, that's about how long it would take to load some of this.
To make a move. For $12 an hour, you could play at 1200 baud.
Hey.
That's just screaming fast, right? Good grief.
It's screaming all right. I don't know if it's screaming fast.
And this was the first graphics-based MMORPG. Now, do you have any you want to mention at all before we get to 96? Because then I've got the biggie.
Well, I figured that we were going to talk about the Ultima series of games.
Right.
Because they were important for the role-playing game world, but they weren't massively multiplayer.
Right. And that will definitely lead into a very important discussion. So Ultima, while we've got this development over here with the multi-user games, there's still quite a bit of work being done in single-player computer role-playing games.
Oh, absolutely. They were huge.
And one of the people who was really spearheading this movement, we did an entire episode on him, Richard Garriott,
mm-hmm.
The Lord British of the Ultima series. He founded the Ultima series. First game was Alcalibeth, which then eventually...
Which he was in college at the time.
Yeah, yeah. And he actually dropped out of college because his computer game business took off so well. His dad, by the way, astronaut.
Yes.
His dad's an astronaut. He drops out of college, makes millions of dollars.
But he was working with...
Don't take that as a lesson, kids. I'm not saying drop out of college.
Your mileage may vary.
Yes.
He was talking in 1990 and 91 about the possibility of an online version of Ultima.
Yeah. Now, Ultima was a series that he created after his first success in computer role-playing games. And in Ultima, the original Ultima games were kind of your standard hack-and-slash RPG-type games where you took on the role of a character and tried to defeat some sort of massively evil villain. But after Ultima 3, Richard Garriott took an interesting turn. He really began to do something new with computer role-playing games. He created the concept of, didn't create the concept, but he incorporated the concept of morality and how your choices can affect gameplay.
Mm-hmm.
And in Ultima 4, you took on the role of a character called the Avatar, who was supposed to be the exemplification of all the best traits in the world.
Mm-hmm.
He was supposed to be the paragon of virtue. And if you played like a nasty person and you stole stuff and you killed innocents, you could not win the game.
Mm-hmm.
It was impossible to win the game because in order to win the game, you had to make lots of sacrifices and be virtuous. And then, this sort of gave a real shot in the arm to his series. I mean, it was already popular,
yeah,
but then it became crazy popular. And so he continued to develop the games. And as the multi-user craze continued with fairly primitive games compared to some of the standalone games on computers,
mm-hmm,
he began to turn his eye toward developing an online version of this Ultima world.
Yeah.
Now, in the meantime, just before this whole plan for an online version of Ultima was in the earliest development phases, another game in 96 came out called Meridian 59.
Mm-hmm.
And that was developed by a company called 3DO, which,
yes,
no longer exists.
They were something of an innovator for their time.
Yes.
But if you've never heard of them, it's because they've been closed for quite a while now.
It's one of the first massively multiplayer online role-playing games ever released by a major publisher.
Yeah.
And a lot of the things that we associate with MMORPGs began with this game. For one, it had a monthly subscription for a flat rate.
Mm-hmm.
So you would pay a flat rate each month to play. It had a 3D first-person view of the world and a fantasy setting.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of MMORPGs do not take the first-person view. Several of them take a third-person view where you're either behind or over the character you're playing.
Yeah.
3DO ran this game, but then it shut down. The 3DO shut down,
yeah,
in 2003. It ceased to be. But
actually, they closed the game on August 31st of 2000, from what I have.
Yeah? Well, the game itself still continued because what happened was in February 2010, Meridian 59 was turned over to the original technical developers, which were a couple of brothers who have opened the game to the public for no charge to the player. So there, it's running on two servers in the United States.
But I love the name of the company though. Near Death Studios.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah. It's just a flesh wound.
The game is when it's hobbling along.
When it's running on two servers, yeah. But it's interesting that it's still, you know, this shows that the people who adopt these games can be very passionate. And even when a studio itself is in financial trouble, people want those games to continue, which is somewhat problematic. Because how do you keep this going when in order to run the game, you actually do have to spend real money?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because you're talking about electricity costs, you're talking about server costs, you're talking about, you know, you might have to have space for that machine. It's tough. And that's not the only time that has happened by a long shot. But so at that same time, Richard Garriott and the folks over at Origin and later Electronic Arts were working on Ultima Online.
Yeah, Ultima Online was apparently originally supposed to go on. Now, keeping in mind the time frame we were originally talking about for that, when I brought it up, we were very much in the online service provider world, and Sierra had its own network it was working on, but they ended up shutting it down, and Ultima Online became an internet MMORPG.
Yeah,
which was probably better for everyone involved because it gave you a much wider audience.
I got to actually see this game in action when it was in its alpha build,
mm-hmm,
before it even opened up to the beta world. Because Richard Garriott came down to a science fiction convention that I go to a lot, Dragon Con in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm.
So Richard Garriott used to be a very frequent guest at Dragon Con. And in fact, he and I kind of struck up a bit of a friendship and we would chat about the games and stuff. And he would show me the games that were in development, including Ultima Online. And it was really a neat thing. It was a kind of a new idea. It was building on that work that other people had done in previous generations of multi-user dungeons, but on a huge scale, and also created a much more dynamic world. So Ultima Online had a world where, in theory anyway, you had ecosystems that could actually be affected by player behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, let's say that you are in a forest and you decide one day that you are the bunny slayer and you go on a bunny slaying rampage and you hack and slash every bunny you can find. Well, there's a limited number of bunnies
yeah,
for a given amount of time. And as you start slaying these bunnies, there are other consequences. For example, there are also wolves in the forest. And now all the bunnies are gone, which means that the food source for the wolves are gone. You know, they no longer have their normal food source. So they might actually venture out of the forest and start to attack villagers. So you could actually inadvertently, while slaying bunnies, as any good hero would want to do, bring terror and hardship upon a village because these wolves are now attacking people.
Mm-hmm.
On the flip side, if you were, you know, Wolfsbane and you were going out into the woods to slay every single wolf you saw, the bunny population might explode and bunnies are everywhere.
Almost like Tribbles.
Yeah. That's just a small example of what was dynamically supposed to happen in the world. And to some degree, it did work like that, although there were definitely some issues as well. It didn't always work exactly the way people had planned. And also, player behavior really, really changed that world quite a bit.
Yeah, if you if you've played recent MMORPG or more recent MMORPGs and been annoyed at the fact that there are people who are playing the game just apparently to make other people miserable.
Called griefers.
Yeah. That started pretty much with the dawn of MMORPGs.
Yeah, no, there were people who would lurk just outside of starting areas and waylay characters, and sometimes they would just do it just to do it. You know, it wasn't,
yeah.
They knew you probably were not carrying anything of value on you. There was no reason to really attack you. There was no real benefit. And yet they would do it because they're jerks. Meanwhile, there were a lot of other problems. There were people who were finding ways to cheat the system. In fact, there was a monumental event. So the game launches in 97.
Yeah.
Well, August of 97, the game has its first monumental event. August 8th, 1997. You know what happened?
I had
August
the 9th.
8th? Oh, was it 9th?
Yeah.
Oh, I've got 8th. But you know what I'm talking about, right?
Well, there was an assassination.
Yes, of Lord British himself. Now, here's the thing. Lord British is normally in the game was invulnerable to attack.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an in-game appearance of Lord British that happened during the beta testing of Ultima Online. So the game had not gone gold yet. It was still – but it was open to players who were in the beta program.
Right.
And so Lord British was showing up during an event in order to kind of stress test the servers. The idea was that if Lord British is there, then most of the beta players are going to be logged on, and this will help the Origin and determine how well their servers can hold up to the strain of a lot of people playing at one time.
Yes.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas.
loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
And then, depending upon whom you ask, something went terribly wrong. Either it was a computer issue or a human issue. And it's kind of hard to say what, although I think I know what really happened. What happened is that the server crashed.
Mm-hmm.
Server reboots.
Right.
Richard Garriott is there as Lord British. Server reboots and resets Lord British, turning off his invulnerability flag. Richard Garriott does not think he need does not realize this and does not turn the invulnerability flag back on. And then there was a character called Reigns,
mm-hmm,
who, testing out this theory, attacked Lord British and killed him. And he was also the player behind Reigns was already kind of notorious on the servers because he was known for exploiting bugs as opposed to reporting bugs.
Well, he was a software consultant,
from
what I understand.
So he was also supposedly one of the earliest griefers in the beta program. So he was one of these people I was talking about in a way.
Yeah.
So, he was already kind of on thin ice. So that it was an amusing situation, and it was an irritating situation. And the game also even had little humorous responses and references to this when it went gold.
Mm-hmm.
But that was one of those memorable moments in MMORPG history. So Ultima Online ends up being the very first MMORPG to hit 100,000 subscribers. It's really successful early on in these early days of the MMORPG.
Yeah, but the next one that I have is going to put it to shame even.
Are you talking about the one from Verint Interactive, later Sony Online Entertainment?
That would be
it. Premiered in 1999.
Yes.
Evercrack.
Yes.
Also known as EverQuest.
Or Neverrest.
Or Neverrest, yeah. Lots of different names for this. Yeah, this was, again, and what's also interesting is so far, Meridian 59, Ultima Online, EverQuest, all three fantasy-based role-playing games.
Yes.
EverQuest launches, and it is a massive success. It was in development at the same time as Ultima Online, had a very different look from Ultima Online, although similar setting in the sense of it's the sword and sorcery realm. And it was one of those games where eventually, if you were talking about an MMORPG, you were talking either about Ultima Online or EverQuest.
Yeah.
And EverQuest's popularity skyrocketed.
That might be an understatement in some ways.
Because
people would play it for hours and hours and lose track of time. And
yep.
There were divorces. And
well, and also it was, you know, they had the benefit of seeing what was not working on Ultima Online.
Yes, that's true.
And building out their world so that it could limit these problems as much as possible. Some problems are hard to get around because they are human generated. And it's hard to create systems that prevent human behavior from happening.
Mm-hmm.
Humans are very good at figuring out ways to get around systems so that they can be jerks. It's just true. we're like, hey, I really wanted to do this one thing. The game's not letting me, but I bet if I try it this way, it'll work. 99 EverQuest launches, but another game also fairly popular, not nearly as popular as EverQuest launches, called Asheron's Call.
Yep.
And that one was from Turbine Entertainment, later on taken over by Microsoft. And Asheron's Call, another fantasy game.
Yeah, it had sort of a different system though. to it. It was sort of a loyalty system where you would basically it was sort of like a lord and vassals kind of situation where the lord was expected to be good to his I assume there were ladies too, but basically in this role, the person at the top of the pyramid is supposed to be expected to be good to their people, for which they would be rewarded, and the people would be able to support their the person at the top of the pyramid.
Yes.
So it was supposed to
kind of like feudalism.
Yeah, it was really supposed to work out in the game, and apparently it was sort of a limited success. But it was a very different kind of system than anyone else had had.
There are a couple of games that really tried to break the mold. And that was one of them, and they've all met with varying degrees of success. 2000 was an interesting year because that's when LucasArts announced that it was developing a game that initially I was very, very eager to get my hands on, called Star Wars Galaxies.
Oh, I remember that, yes.
So it was announced in 2000, and the original launch date was going to be in 2001, but it was delayed until 2003. The setting of the game, first of all, set in the Star Wars universe, obviously, but the actual setting of the game was set after the events of Episode 4, often just called Star Wars, also known as, A New Hope.
Yeah.
So A New Hope just ended, so Death Star's blown up, that's when the game is set, and you could actually encounter characters from the films as you played the game. But there were a lot of issues people had with this game. There were some gameplay issues. There were some story issues. There were people who were very upset that the Jedi system was kind of weird in Star Wars Galaxies. In order to be a Jedi, you know, keep in mind, set during the original trilogy, not a lot of Jedi in that original trilogy. You essentially had Luke, and then you had, you know, Darth Vader, the Dark Lord of the Sith, and you had Yoda. And then as far as you knew, that was it. Those, Obi-Wan in the first film, but then he dies, spoiler alert. And so, you didn't have that many Jedi running around. I mean, the idea was that Darth Vader had gone and pretty much killed all the rest of them. So, because, you know, they wanted the game to be true to the lore of Star Wars as much as possible, they did not want it to be easy to go out and create a Jedi. Because if it were, then everyone would go out and create a Jedi, and then you'd suddenly have a Star Wars universe where 100,000 Jedi are running around. It wouldn't feel like Star Wars. So what they did was they created a system that was difficult to discover how to unlock the Jedi. It was almost it seemed almost random. Like there was this list of criteria you had to complete, and the list was never made public. But so the game launched in 2003. The first person to unlock the Jedi slot character did it within, I think, 4 months after the game launched. They later on changed the requirements for becoming a Jedi and made it a quest that you could take so that you would have a very specific pathway you could take in order to become a Jedi. Because people were saying, Star Wars, the coolest people in Star Wars are the Jedi. They're the ones that have all the really cool powers. They have the lightsabers. These guys are awesome, and you're making it impossible for me to find out how to play one. So it was a very frustrating experience for people. Well, these problems continued, among other issues, including things like reefers and cheaters, that sort of stuff. And the game was ultimately shut down in 2011, partially because there was another Star Wars game on the horizon, but we'll get to that in a little bit.
Yeah, I was a little surprised that you didn't mention Dark Age of Camelot in 2001.
Well, it's because the Star Wars Galaxies was originally announced in 2000.
I see.
But yeah, in 2001, Dark Age of Camelot came out, and that was an interesting game too, because that focused a lot on player versus player gameplay.
Mm-hmm. And it was specifically set within the world of King Arthur.
Yes.
Arthurian legend.
Yeah, another fantasy. But yeah.
Yeah, but a very specific fantasy, though.
That's true. The interesting thing about this is that you had games where player versus player combat was possible because a lot of people wanted to have the ability to test their characters against other people's characters and play against them.
Mm-hmm.
There were other games that really stressed player cooperation, and some did not even allow player versus player interaction. You had to, you could not attack another player. Some games tried to split the difference, where within certain regions, there was no way you could attack another player. Mm-hmm. If you ventured outside of those regions, outside of those safe zones, then you could attack or be attacked by other players. And then there was another way of doing this, where games would create specific servers, where if you would log on to certain servers, they'd be player-friendly in the sense that you are not going to be attacked by any other player because it that's the kind of server it is. And other servers are player versus player servers where it's anything goes. Mm-hmm. And lots of different experimentation during this time to find out what's the right way of going about it. And to this day, companies are still experimenting with that.
Mm-hmm. It also had the people in the game, the characters in the game, as part of a basically specific tribes.
Yeah.
Basically the English, the Norse, and the Celtic groups. When and each of them had specific attributes at which they excelled.
Yep.
For example, the Celts were particularly good at magic, the Norse were better at melee combat. And that's something, again, these systems, if you'll notice, these systems are the kinds of things that are pretty common across all of the current MMORPGs, but it's sort of like they're being rolled out game by game, and people are they're sort of picking up to the point where they take A, B, C, D, and E, where before they were just sort of this is an okay game, but look at this one thing. It's so cool.
Yeah.
Anyway.
2001 was also when Anarchy Online launched.
Ah, yes.
As a science fiction-based game. So breaking the mold. I mean, Star Wars Galaxies had not come out yet. It had been announced, but it hadn't come out. And you could also argue that Star Wars is, in fact, a fantasy, not science fiction. I would not argue against that.
I think it's both.
I think that when most of the explanations for the technology within Star Wars really boil down to magic, it pretty much is just fantasy.
Well, yeah, but the thing is, well, anyway.
A lightsaber's a magic sword. I mean, it really is. But
But blasters and land speeders are technology, which is
one could argue.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. It's got the trappings of science fiction. It's a fantasy.
Exactly.
So Anarchy Online was science fiction based. It had some pretty major technical issues when it launched and had particular problems handling large loads of players. So if a lot of people tried to play on one server, there were a lot of issues with lag and server stability. So it had some issues when it launched. There's still a lot of people who really love that game, but there were a lot of problems with it.
It did have several expansions, though.
Yes, it did.
And this is the period in which you started to see a lot of that.
Yeah, EverQuest was infamous for the expansions I think 16 different expansions came out for EverQuest.
Yeah.
So that's, these were ways to increase the appeal of the game to the longtime players who had pretty much achieved everything they could do within the base game.
Yeah.
Now, why would they keep playing? And remember, these games are based on not just a purchase price, but a monthly subscription.
Right.
And so you want to try and keep those players around as long as possible. Well, one way to do that is to release expansions that continue to engage players even after they have completed, a massive percentage of the base game.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 2002, we saw the launch of Final Fantasy XI.
Online.
So it launched in Japan on the PlayStation 2 at that time. So it was available on multiple platforms. In fact, that was a big deal. It was a massively multiplayer online game that was supporting platforms across various kinds of machines. So it wasn't, you didn't have to just play the game on one particular computer. In fact, the same servers were supporting the game for multiple platforms.
And you might say, well, so what's the big deal about consoles? Well, keep in mind that consoles, for the most part, don't necessarily have keyboards. And so if you want to talk, this is part of the, the online multiplayer experience. You want to communicate with your teammates to achieve whatever goals, to slay the dragon or to break into the fortress or whatever that you're trying to accomplish.
Or to you need irritate to be able to, them.
Or to irritate people, taunt people. You need to be able to communicate with one another.
Yeah.
And so now they're starting to figure out ways, convenient ways to do that, to make that happen.
Right. In 2003, by the way, there are a lot of games that come out over in Asia that fall into this category that I'm not really going to talk about. I'm talking mostly about the ones that were played in the Western Hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
because that's where the majority of our listeners are from. But in 2003, Ubisoft launches a game called Shadowbane. And Shadowbane, the interesting thing to me about Shadowbane was that the idea behind it was that the game's events would not be pre-generated quests. Because for a lot of these MMORPGs, you create a character. There are certain quests within the world that exist and have existed for everyone that you can go and complete. So your buddy can go and they get a quest from this person. Hey, this inn is full of rats. I need you to clean it out. And your buddy goes in and cleans out all the rats. And then you go up to that same person. That person says, hey, this inn is full of rats. I need you to clean them out. Then you can go and clean out all the rats. Shadowbane was different. It depended upon the players to generate the content and the events within the game that would affect everyone, which is pretty cool. It's also putting a lot of responsibility on the backs of the players. So I can't tell you exactly how well it worked because I never played Shadowbane. I just thought it was interesting to try and go about making a game in that way. I have played in games where the game content was supposed to be player-generated, and I got to tell you, for every cool event that happens, there's about 20 hours of nothing happening.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's C-O-N-C-U-R.com.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
One phenomenon we didn't mention, and it's really not core to what we're talking about, but just to show the popularity of MMORPGs in the early 2000s is also when we start talking about people trading real money for stuff in games.
Yes.
And spawning its own economy. Of course, that became a problem for a lot of people, you know, gold farming, as they call it.
Yeah. So you had, it's kind of crazy.
It's coming across many platforms and many games.
Yeah. You had people willing to pay real money to get in-game resources to make their players stronger within the game, which is kind of interesting because you think you could be using that real money to get you real resources to make you happier in real life, but people were deriving so much pleasure from the games themselves that they wanted to deck out their characters with the best stuff that they could possibly get. And in some cases it wasn't like, some cases it was so that they could show off. Some cases it was so that they could take advantage of other players more effectively. Some people just wanted, you know, they really liked playing the game and they just wanted to have the coolest stuff that they could get for their character.
And they really didn't have the time or the inclination to go get it themselves.
Yeah, because sometimes you're talking about items that would drop only if you killed a certain monster and not always, you know, it wouldn't always drop. So in other words, you might have to face off against this particularly powerful creature and use a lot of your resources, like health potions or whatever, mm-hmm. in order to take the creature down. And then the creature drops items, and it may even be that, you know, it's only a certain percentage of the time will it drop the item you're specifically looking for.
Right.
To make it more complicated, you would have games where other players could pick up an item when it dropped. And so it may only drop that one item, but then there's 50 people all trying to grab it at the same time, and there's only one instance of that item. Well, then, you know, that would cause problems too. Because you have people who would camp out waiting for a monster to regenerate in order for them to go in and try and farm out this particular item. And it, for some people, it was worthwhile. For others, they just said, this doesn't make the game fun if I'm just, you know, competing against all these people to wait for this one monster to load so I can get this one item. You know, this feels more like work than a game. And that became a problem for some people.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a problem today, depending upon how the game handles items. There are a lot of games now that will drop items that are specific only to that one character, so that each character that is participating in, say, a raid all has access to the same general stuff. But if they take it, it does not get removed from the other person's game.
Mm-hmm.
So if we are banding together and we take down a monster and that monster drops 20 gold, you get to pick up 20 gold. I get to pick up 20 gold. And it's not like the 20 gold only exists for the two of us.
Right.
So, anyway, moving on to 2004, which was a big year in MMORPGs.
Again, I'm surprised you didn't mention EVE Online, which also debuted in 2004.
Yeah, I thought about that and then I didn't. Did
okay.
you want to say anything about EVE Online?
Well, EVE Online is still very popular.
Yeah.
It's made by a European company named CCP Games, and very predominantly male too, from what I understand. It's a big still very very popular with space exploration and basically space combat. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the Star Wars games, you might actually be a character. And, you know, on your feet, most of what I've seen of EVE Online is space-based. So, you know, you have your ship and you're doing stuff, and there's interstellar commerce and that kind of thing. Obviously, I've never played, but I do know some people who do, and they really love it. So,
yeah, no,
and it's got a big following, which is why I thought, you know, you should mention it.
It's, you know, always,
or
again,
one of us should.
Nice to see a game that does not necessarily just fall into the sword and sorcery.
That's true.
Realm. So next we have in 2004 three big ones. EverQuest 2, which, you know, because EverQuest, even with the expansion packs, was starting to show its age. And EverQuest 2 was an opportunity for, well, to sell more copies of games for one thing, but also to update the graphics and game engine beyond what an expansion pack could do.
Right.
And so EverQuest 2 launches. City of Heroes.
Ah, yes.
Launches. So now you've got this superhero, supervillain kind of games launching, which was a neat expansion on MMORPGs. And then the big game that is on the tip of everyone's tongue when they talk about MMORPGs, World of Warcraft, mm-hmm. which I think you cannot describe anything other than phenomenal success.
Oh, yes.
I mean, it was a true phenomenon. There are over 10 million people playing that game. Now, remember, when Ultima Online launched, it was a big deal when they hit 100,000 subscribers. Now we're talking about 10 million people playing this game.
Yeah, and I know that the largest number I've seen attributed to it was a couple years ago now. We're recording this in 2012, where they had hit 12 million at
yeah.
one point, maybe even 13.
So,
but it has declined in the past year or two, but not – it's still going.
Yeah, there are plenty of people who still play.
Oh, yes.
And,
absolutely.
And the expansion packs have really continued the the development of that world, so much so that they destroyed it at one point. Cataclysm completely turned the world upside down, and it upset some players because things changed so dramatically. But the whole point of it was that the player base for WoW was made up a lot. You know, a lot of the player base were old-time players who had been playing forever, and you know, you have to keep making things interesting. And adding a new realm every now and then and upping the level cap by 5 only goes so far.
Yeah.
And so there have been some calculated risks of really shaking the game up in order to keep longtime players around and interested, because now they've got, you know, even places that seemed familiar are now new to them.
Mm-hmm.
For new players, it was a little confusing. So you'd ask like a level 78 character, hey, how do I get to such and such? And like, well, I can tell you how you used to be able to get there. I don't know how you get there now.
Take a left at the barrel.
I should have taken a left in Albuquerque. So yeah, those games, all three of those games were made a big impact. And, you know, it was at this point that you really started to see some real competition between games, because there are only so many gamers out there who want to play online role-playing games. And subscriptions can start to rack up. I mean, these are not necessarily cheap. It may be somewhere in the realm of, you know, $20 to $30 a month. $20 to $30 a month to play. And, you know, you start playing multiple games, you only have so much time to dedicate to each game. So the competition was pretty fierce. World of Warcraft ran with this and did really well. 2008, there was a game that launched that, you know, and other games again launched between 2004 and 2008. But
like
in 2000,
Guild Wars?
Yeah, Guild Wars is a good one. That's actually a really good example.
Or D&D Online.
D&D Online, which changed from, and it's not the only one. In fact, the one I'm about to mention also did this. D&D Online and Age of Conan, which launched in 2008. Mm-hmm. Both of those were games that you would pay for originally.
Yeah.
And you did a monthly subscription. Both of those games also came out with free to play models, where you could play the game for free, but you would not have access to all the content.
Mm-hmm.
And depending upon the way the game model was, like in Age of Conan, you could switch from a free account to a paid account, and then you would get access to all the premium content. D&D Online had a system where you could pay money for in-game credits and use those in-game credits to unlock areas of the game.
Mm-hmm.
So it was experimenting with different ways to get players engaged with the game and enough so that they'd be willing to pay to play the whole thing. And I don't know how successful that was, honestly. I mean, it's not the only time we've seen that, too. We've also seen online role-playing games where if you pay real money, you get access to in-game resources.
Mm-hmm.
This is also carried over into casual games. We've seen that when we had our episode about casual games. We talked about games where you can pay cash to get an advantage in the game.
Freemium.
And it's also a fairly controversial approach, because you've got gamers who are saying, this takes skill out of it. If I just have deep enough pockets, I can get an advantage over everyone else in the game, and it has no bearing on whether I play the game well or not. And, you know, there's something to that, but guess what? That's what real life is about, too. I hate to tell you. But real life, if you have a lot of money, you can make up for a basic lack of skills, as it turns out. You can hire people who have skills for you. And then I wanted to end my discussion, anyway, on a game that launched in 2012.
Okay.
Sort of like tail end of 2011, into 2012. It's a little game called Star Wars The Old Republic.
Ah, yes.
We have finally reached the one MMORPG I actually play.
All right.
I have not played any other MMORPG. I've seen them developed. I've played on someone else's account just to get a feel for it, but I've never actually got an account myself. I mean, mm-hmm. I did play a little bit of D&D online for about a couple of months, but.
Well, you wrote an article for the site.
Yes. And as that, I created an account so I could play it, so I could get a better understanding of how it worked. So Star Wars The Old Republic, there are a couple of reasons why I wanted to play it. One is that my hatred for Star Wars has not gotten that out of hand yet. The prequels really did a number on me, people.
Yes,
they
did.
Don't get me started.
Please don't.
But I still, despite all that, I still love the Star Wars universe. And I really love the Knights of the Old Republic games, which are set up almost 4,000 years before the original trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
Star Wars The Old Republic is set about 3,500 years before the original trilogy. So there are no characters from the original trilogy or any of the Star Wars movies that are in the games.
Right.
The games you're encountering, you know, ancestors several generations removed from anyone in the film series. The nice thing about that is that you don't have to worry about impacting the world so much that the movies could not have happened.
Right.
Right? Because that was one of the problems, is that you want this rich world that Lucas created that people find so interesting and compelling, but they didn't want to create it in such a way that if you did one set of actions, you invalidate what happens in the movies, because then you've just invalidated the reason why everyone loves it in the first place. So that's a tricky balance. Well, by setting it 3,500 years before the events of the films, you kind of take that causation away. And the Knights of the Old Republic games were a lot of fun for me. So I wanted to play this, and I ended up getting an account. And I do play my main character, in case you're all wondering, is an Imperial agent. You can play either as the Imperial side or the Rebel side. It's not the same as the movies. And depending on which side you're on, you can play light side or dark side.
Mm-hmm.
So you could be a light side Imperial agent if you wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not. I play the dark side. Yeah, every time I choose the dark side option. And so, anyway, it's a really fun game set in the Star Wars universe, and I've been having a blast with it. And it makes me think that if I had had a broadband connection earlier, I probably would have gotten into MMORPGs earlier. Now, the way I play it more as a single-player kind of experience, and I only occasionally team up with people, because I just haven't made that many friends on Star Wars The Old Republic yet. But who knows? Maybe after this podcast goes live, folks will track me down and be like, hey, man, I'll help you out. You're having trouble taking that Mandalorian down? And I will say, yes. Yes, I am. That guy is tough, and he's really irritating me.
So, yeah, there are scads of other games that we haven't mentioned.
Oh, yes.
Some very high-profile games.
Dozens.
Like Halo games and...
Yeah, and there are other games that are massively multiplayer. In fact, I'd argue the Halo games fit in this, where there's not role playing involved, but it is a massively multiplayer online game.
Yes.
So you can have a lot of people playing at once, even though they're not necessarily role playing.
Yeah, it's funny because I think in a way, some of it's fuzzy, to be honest.
Yeah.
There are different degrees of the role playing involved.
Yes.
When you're playing you, is that really playing a role?
Yeah. Yeah. But, so, and again, there are people who get into the role playing and there are people who despise the role playing.
Yeah.
And sometimes you'll have companies create servers just for role players so that the role players can be all, you know, the hardcore gamers might say that's all hippy dippy. So the role players can be all hippy dippy on their own servers, and everyone who's just, you know, who just wants to play the game can be on their servers. I like a balance between the two, so I'm somewhere in the middle. I don't really identify myself with either group. So anyway, that's kind of a bird's eye view of the history of MMORPGs. We really have Dungeons and Dragons to thank for it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that the games would have developed on their own without it, but that was truly an inspiration. And
yeah,
D&D is just
kick in the pants there.
And role playing games in general go well beyond just D&D.
Oh yes,
you can find tons and tons of them. Some of them are out of print now. But there have been games ranging across all genres, from horror to science fiction, mystery, just about everything you can think about. There is a role-playing game out there that fits it. So guys, if you have any suggestions for topics that we should tackle in future episodes, please let us know. You can send us an email. Our address is techstuff@discovery.com, or let us know on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle there is techstuffhsw, and Chris and I will game with you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.